IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. I'm your host, Shri Krishna Upadhyaya. And my guest today on the show is Anupam Manur, Professor of Economics at Takshashila. Welcome to All Things Policy, Anupam. Very happy to have you back.
Hi, Shri. Amazing to be here.
So today is February 29th. It's special because it comes once in 4 years. And it's also special because Anupam, you, Kathy and Pranay have authored a book which is hitting the stands today. We the Citizens is the name of the book. It's a comic book in public policy, perhaps first of its kind. So I must congratulate you for the book launch and wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the free publicity as well. So folks, you heard it right. It's in the bookstores. It's on Amazon. Go and purchase it.
Right. So the topic of today's conversation between me and Anupam is something very interesting. It is about fixing medical rates in all the hospitals of the country. And this we are talking about today because yesterday, that is on 28th of February, there was a news report which said that the Supreme Court of India has asked the central government or the union government to look at fixing medical charges that can be availed by any hospital for any treatment within a particular price band, right? And they have relied on a particular law passed in 2012 called the Clinical Establishment Act. And in a public interest litigation filed by an NGO called Veterans Forum, because it's a very interesting name.
Veterans Forum for Transparency in Public Life.
Exactly. Yeah. Thanks for that, Anupam. So Veterans Forum for Public Transparency in Public Life had filed a PIL before the Supreme Court. In this PIL, the court has given an order that the the union government has to look into fixing price bands for all the treatments and procedures that one can avail at hospitals in different states of the country, which will, in case the government fails to do, will be as per the rates fixed under the central government health scheme. So that is the crux of the order. We'll break it down even a bit because this poses a lot of interesting questions from both a legal and economics perspective. And to cover the legal perspective, I am here and to have thoughts on the economics behind this whole issue. We have Anupam on the show today. So very happy to be talking about this because I believe it's an important issue. Medical inflation is real. Healthcare costs are unaffordable to a large chunk of the population. And we all know the state of public healthcare in the country, right? So given all these problems, the court has tried to intervene in this issue and has directed the government to come back with a reply in another 6 months. And if the government fails to, come up with the fixed rates for all the medical procedures, the court will go ahead and enforce the CGHS rates in all hospitals. So one of the things that the court noted before giving this direction is that we have a fundamental right to healthcare in India, right? All citizens are entitled to a fundamental right to health. And I believe, Anupam, you have very strong exceptions regarding this. So let's begin by talking about this. What do you think of fundamental right to healthcare? And why is it important?
So you are the lawyer. I can assume that you know the Constitution rather well. And I'm saying I can assume because apparently the Supreme Court doesn't know the Constitution really well. Because I went through all of the fundamental rights all over again. I tried to look at, every single word that was mentioned there with a microscope. I actually didn't find any phrasing which said fundamental right to healthcare. Now, I could be mistaken. Maybe it's in a secret passage somewhere else or, you have to burn the page in a particular light and this will emerge from there. I don't know. But the Constitution, yeah, as it is, a standard edition of the Constitution does not mention that we have a fundamental right to healthcare, right? We'll talk about why that's problematic to think of fundamental rights, but you as a lawyer, please let me know, am I missing something?
Yeah, so Anupam, I think it's actually a part of jurisprudence of the Supreme Court and the higher courts that started post 1980s, thanks to the PILs. Where they started reading in a lot of positive rights, so to speak, which are socioeconomic rights, into the Article 21 of the Constitution, which talks about the right to life and personal liberty. So at least in the judiciary's mind, it's clear. They have a long list of precedents which talk about the fundamental right to health care, which can be found in Article 21. And the meaning of this can, in fact, be derived from DPSPs, right? The directive principles. So the directive principles actually somewhere talk about, you know, improving public health care and providing a certain minimum standard of health care to all citizens. So it's a purely a judicial invention. It's called, you know, this. It's backed by the theory of the theory of, you know, the organic growth of constitution, where, you know, you interpret it in a different way to give it broader meaning to expand the scope of rights. But I don't know, from a public policy perspective, right, it's entirely questionable, because this is not found in a textual reading of constitution. Like you said, I don't think any mantra or tantric stuff that you do with the constitution will produce a fundamental right to you anywhere, up to healthcare anywhere. But that's the long and short of it, right? It's a judicial creation. And the court, in fact, notes one of the decisions called Parmanand Katara, which again is from 30, 40 years ago, in its order yesterday as well, which sort of established this fundamental right to healthcare. And that forms the basis of the rest of the court's direction.
Right. Now, yeah. So I'm assuming that all of this is coming from that overarching kind of right to life.
Yeah.
Right. That's where this is coming from. And I can see why there is, of course, a right to life. But that just means that somebody cannot take your life away from you. Right. So it's a very clear external party which can include the state, of course. So the state or any other external party cannot take your life away from you without due process and all of those things. Right. It has nothing to say that you can't have a toothache.
Yeah.
You know, right to life does not, I mean, whether the courts know it or not, or they understand it or not, they can't prevent people from falling sick and falling ill. Right, you can't prevent those things. So you will fall sick and fall ill. Now, hospitals and those remedies is one part of it. But fixing prices to hospitals is not really, I do not think it's a right to life angle at all. I mean, I know the honorable judges of the Supreme Court have a different take on this. But let's now break it down for in public policy terms as to why this is problematic, right? Because, I mean, listeners who might not know me might think of me as just a cruel, horrible, unempathetic. I mean, I am all of those things, but, but you know, cruel, unempathetic person who says, okay, people should not live, or we don't care if people fall ill and so on. No, that's not the case. Anytime that we say somebody has a right to something, that comes with incredible costs. So first, there is something called positive rights and negative rights. Negative rights is where, for example, somebody, where there is no cost associated, from economic terms, there's no cost associated with you enjoying those rights. So me having a right to freedom, right? Right to freedom of life, right to freedom of liberty, right to freedom of something else, there's no cost associated with providing that particular right to me. Right? So if I say I have right to speech, freedom of speech, then I can talk in this. It doesn't really cost anybody when I speak. I mean, okay, it's costing all of you your time now while listening to me speak, but you know, there's no cost associated with providing that right. Whereas anytime that we say there's right to life in terms of healthcare, there's a very clear cost associated to that. Who bears that cost? When we say, for example, and this, there's no end to this meaningless nonsense as well, right? We can say right to, for example, there's people talk about right to internet. People talk about right to education, which we have an act called right to education. We have, you know, then there'll be right to water and right to electricity. And, you know, basically all the good things in life, and everybody will agree these are good things to life, health and, you know, electricity and water and internet. And, you know, very soon I can say right to YouTube, because that is good. I mean, it entertains me, right to Netflix. Why not right to good meals in a five-star restaurant, right? Where do we stop this? Is all good things a right? And then if all good things are right, who pays for it ultimately? So, because once you say that it's a right, which is guaranteed by the Constitution, then the government has to make sure that it's provided. Now, the government can make sure that it's provided through one of two ways. It can provide it itself, or it can mandate others to provide it. If it mandates others to provide it and provide it for free or at some price of its choosing, then isn't that, and Sri, this is where I want you to come in, isn't that a fundamental violation of the other right, which is right to freedom? Right to freedom of their own life and livelihood and, you know, economic freedom, right? Because there is a freedom for trade and so on. Now, you're saying somebody should provide for this, not charge a price that they want, right? Or even give it for free because there's whatever rights that you have imagined up. And basically, you're coming in the way of their own right to, well, earn a profit, earn a livelihood, earn a basic whatever, their income, right? So you're saying you have to give it for free. How is that? How can you make sense of all of this?
Right. So Anupam, I'll tell you how the judiciary has made sense of this is by, you know, declaring certain activities as non-commercial or, you know, non-profitable. For example, they did this with education, which still surprises me, that, you know, apparently in India, education is not a profit-making activity. You cannot run school or colleges for profits. Instead, you should charge only whatever the state decides, a fixed rate of fees for admission and so on, because you're carrying out a charitable activity. So what they did was they simply excluded running an educational service from the ambit of your economic freedom, right? And I still think that's problematic because anybody who's gotten an admission in private school or colleges, especially in Bangalore, where you have to pay donation, you know, quote unquote donation, knows that this is simply not the case, right? I mean, that just, you know, screws up the incentives for all the players involved. But I'm fearing something similar can be said of the health as well, right? You simply say that, oh, you know, doctors are a noble profession anyway. So hospitals are supposed to follow the rates fixed by the government and should not be indulging in, you know, dirty profit making, so to speak. Until and unless somebody comes up and says, you know, lawyers are also engaging in a noble profession. So why are lawyers allowed to charge the fees they want? So let's see what the judges have to say about that when it comes to that, you know. So
yeah, and you can stretch this. I mean, honestly, everything is a noble profession, if you ask me. There is no ignoble profession at all. Either everything is noble or nothing is noble. Because if anybody supplies a product for me, which I need, for me, that is automatically noble. Or not, right? I mean, I will make the argument that a prostitute is as noble, prostitution is as noble a profession as anything else in the world, that satisfying a particular need. Farmers, are you saying, okay, then, you know, we can stretch this. Are farmers also, it's also a noble profession, right?
Right.
Should we say that they should not profit? Should we say that they should not charge any money? Why don't we expect all of them to provide this thing? And yeah, as you said, I think the most noble profession is one who delivers justice. So I think from tomorrow onwards, we should make a strong argument that judges should not seek any salary.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so I know I am you know, this is reductio ad absurdum. I'm reducing the argument to its absurd level. But I really want to use this as a rhetorical device to make the point that you cannot impose your own set of morality of what is noble and what is not noble. You cannot impose your idea of an ideal society where something should be less costly, something should be more costly, something should be free, etc. Which is why constitution should remain to only the set of negative rights, right? Right to freedoms, right to this thing, you know, those are the set which is already enshrined. Do not read extra into that and start providing other rights. Because as I said, I can take that same set of arguments and then stretch it. Because there are already people who talk about right to internet.
Yeah.
What about, right? I mean, you know, you can say there's a right to movement, right? Right to assembly and right to movement. Can I then use that to say I need all airfares to be either extremely cheap, fixed by the government, or to be free, right? I mean, you can stretch this in any direction, which is why it is it's extraordinarily incumbent upon the court not to stretch this.
Yeah.
And, you know, and confine it to exactly what is already just there.
That's what. So when you talk of right to internet, then it also predicates something like right to a mobile phone or a right to any device which enables you to access internet. Then it's about, you know, right to electricity because you need to charge those devices and so on. But I have to clarify.
Right to MacBook Air. Huh?
Yeah, I have to clarify this by stating that, you know, this does not mean there is no right to freedom on the internet. That's a separate issue, right? That's actually about your negative liberty. That's about right to freedom of speech on the internet. Anyway, I think we are sort of digressing. Let's go back to what the Supreme Court did in its order on fixing the rates for medical services in the country, right? So a little bit about this NGO, Veterans Forum for Transparency in Public Life. It's involved in a series of PILs in both High Court in Himachal Pradesh and Supreme Court. This particular PIL was filed in 2020. Where they said that, look, the cost of healthcare is increasing everywhere, which is fair, and said that there is a particular rule under the Clinical Establishment Registration and Regulation Act of 2010. And this rule requires two things. One is, all hospitals and clinical establishments must display rates charged for each type of service provided and facilities at a conspicuous place in their premises. And secondly, they must charge rates for each type of procedure and services within the range of rates determined and issued by from time to time by the central government in consultation with state government. So this NGO said that this particular range of rates has not been determined by the union government for the longest time in the last 12, 14 years. So they requested directions from the Supreme Court asking the center to do this. Now the central government simply said, okay, the state governments are not responding. So now the court said, look, you have a fundamental right to healthcare. The objective of this law is to give medical facilities to citizens at an affordable price. So the government has been sitting on its bottom and not implementing the provisions of this act. Hence, we give direction that, you have 6 weeks, figure it out, fix the range of rates for all medical services in all hospitals, including private hospitals. In case you don't do that, we will enforce the rates which is fixed by the government under the Central Government Health Scheme, which is actually a scheme which is applicable to the families of central government employees and their families, right? So this is the crux of the order. Now, I have a lot of holes to pick because the court, I think, has not only exceeded its brief, but also it has floundered on like very basic legal aspects. But before that, any comments from you, Anupam, so far?
Oh, I have a lot, but I'll let you finish. I have a lot of comments, as you can expect.
All right.
But we'll do it one by one.
Okay, so I'll get some technical arguments out of the way, which I believe are still important, right? So when the court said that the avowed objective of this law, Clinical Establishments Act, is to provide medical facilities to the citizens at an affordable place, I must humbly submit that this is fully misplaced, right? Because this law is not to provide medical facilities. It is simply a law for providing registration and regulation of clinical establishments in the country and for fixing minimum standards of facilities and services which may be provided by them. Right? This is not a law which talks about right to healthcare of citizens at all. It is a governing or regulatory law meant for registering clinical establishments in the country. Okay, so this reliance on this law itself is misplaced, right? Now, the second question is, if the law is about a particular thing, which is about registering clinical establishments, which is sort of the legal lingo for hospitals and healthcare facilities, how can the rules under the law require that the government fix range of rates for healthcare, right? Now, there's something called the theory of delegated legislation, right? So the legislature, the parliament in this case, can leave some rulemaking and regulation-making powers to the executive, which is the union government in this case. However, the rulemaking powers do not extend the scope of the Parent Act, or they cannot, rather, because then they will fall afoul of the Parent Act. Now, for example, if the Parent Act is saying, okay, you have the powers to regulate and register clinical establishments, unless and until it specifically gives you the power to fix prices as well, which is a whole different ballgame than simply regulating, the court should not even have entertained this. In fact, the rules which the court is relying on must be struck down as ultra vires of the parent statute, right? I think this is a very important point which has to be brought to the notice of the court in future. And the other thing, which is intriguing, is this law does not apply to all states in the country. This was brought in by the parliament on recommendation of certain states. As of today, it applies to around 12 states in the country, the big ones being UP, Telangana, Jharkhand, Rajasthan, Haryana, and some other smaller states in the Northeast and so on, and it applies to union territories. And the scope of the Supreme Court's order is not clear. Is it only talking about these particular states, or is it planning to apply this law to everywhere across the board, right? And this is important because healthcare is a state subject, and in our federal structure, we have to respect the separation of legislative domain and policy-making prerogative and so on, which we'll come to in a bit. And the final point I want to make is on...
Before you go there, Shri, I want to just clarify on this because we might not come back to this. So we know that healthcare, for example, is a state subject. So can the court really pull up the state for not doing their bit on fixing the prices or whatever else that the, let's say, either the union government has put in its rules and what the Supreme Court is now interpreting that to be? So can you actually pull up the state saying you have to do this? Is that, I mean, from a legal perspective?
From a legal point, I think that's not only something the court can do, but the court must do it, right? Because right now the petitioner is just the Union of India. The states are not even being heard by the court. So I think even in, you know, basic procedure that you have to hear all the affected parties, that requires the state government, at least these state 12 states and 7 union territories, to have been made party to this dispute, which has not been the case. So I think at least on that point, the court really should have made them the parties, right? Final couple of points, Anupam, before I hand it over to you. One is the comparison with the central government health scheme, right? And saying that, oh, we are going to enforce the rates which is being fixed by the government under the CGHS. I think this is also very misplaced because CGHS is a voluntary scheme, right? Hospitals can choose to get empaneled, right? Private hospitals can go to the government, whatever, fulfill the required criteria and get themselves empaneled as a CGHS hospital and start treating patients which are covered under this particular scheme. It is in no way coercive. The government can't force anyone. The hospitals are willingly agreeing that, okay, we are going to offer these services and charge the specified rates so that the government reimburses. They may do it for whatever reasons, financial stability, regular patient intake or whatever, right? But using this rate card to sort of like, you know, splash it across all hospitals in the country is again problematic because you're essentially engaging in a more coercive exercise. Now, the final thing is, you know, I think this was not part of the order of the court, but it came up during the hearings, is that, oh, wait, didn't the government fix rates for, you know, medical treatment during COVID? Well, yes, a lot of governments, in fact, did. Even the Karnataka government, I remember, fixed, oh, this is the ICU package, or this is the ward package, and so on. So medical rates were fixed. Except it was not done under the statute. In fact, this law does not even apply to Karnataka, which has its own statute, right? This was done under the Disaster Management Act. Since COVID was an emergency situation and there was a pandemic going on and all, for a short period of time, a lot of governments decided to fix rates for COVID treatment. And this, I think, has been taken away or it has fallen away in most places. So again, using COVID, which is a once-in-a-lifetime sort of pandemic and an emergency situation, and making that the basis for, you know, fixing what your dental surgery should cost in a particular hospital is also a bit problematic. So I'll pause here. These are my observations on the court's order. I think a lot of holes are there which need to be picked. But Anupam, your thoughts?
Yeah, I massively disagree with price fixing, even during something like COVID. I don't think it worked. I think it is also an extraordinary impingement on the rights of those hospitals to, you know, conduct their business as they want and so on. I find even that problematic. And then to use that as justification for doing something like this is even, I mean, it's completely unacceptable, right? Let's go one, you know, again, in a slightly structured manner if we can. But both you and the courts have made an observation, and the PIL, etc., have made an observation that healthcare is getting expensive. I want to, you know, first object to that itself. Is healthcare really getting more expensive? I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, if you look at data, is the rupee amount that we paid today more than the rupee amount that we paid, I don't know, 10 years back? Yeah, I think you'll find yes. Even that, not for all things, by the way. I mean, I think certain parts of healthcare just didn't exist. So you can't even compare. I mean, now, you know, like 20 years back, there was probably very few MRI machines in the country and most people couldn't even have access to it. Right now, if you have a small hairline fracture, they'll tell you to get an MRI, right? So some of those things have fundamentally changed. So you can't even compare. It's not as simple as just saying, okay, today for a cataract surgery, we pay 30,000, whereas, you know, 30 years back, it was 10,000. I mean, that is so simplistic, so as to be bordering on idiotic, right? Because a few things. One, you have to look at this in not nominal terms, but in real terms. What is the rate of inflation been over these years, right? And India is a country which is prone to slightly higher inflation than, you know, many advanced countries. So you can expect, if you have a standard kind of maybe average inflation rate of 6%, you can expect this to increase in 6% as well. So that is just one. But two, there is something called, you know, I mean, obviously there's technological advancement that has happened, right? So you can have, let's say, maybe a dental surgery or whatever, root canal treatment a few years back, which was cheaper, but it was also 10 times more painful than what it is today. We have so much advancement in terms of the kind of x-rays that is done, the, you know, 360 degrees x-ray that is done. You have, you know, so much advancement in, for example, pain numbing creams, pain, you know, local applicators, etc. Unlike, you know, previously you used to have to undergo all of this in extreme pain. So is there no cost of that reduction in pain? So I can go on. There's in every aspect. I'm not a doctor, so I can't really justify some of these things, but I hope what I'm saying makes sense, right? On all of these things, the kind of technological advancements that have been made has been tremendous. And so therefore, there's a cost attached to those things. And if you ask most people, they would rather pay a little bit more for lesser pain than otherwise, right? So I think there you have it. I mean, that's one of the reasons why, if at all, the nominal amount has gone up. So one, you have to make it inflation adjusted. Two, you have to look for what is the technological advancement. And three, I think, is also the fact that people's disposable income have actually gone up. So you have to do that in comparison as well, right? So it's not just, you know, absolute numbers of how much it's paying, but maybe as a proportion of your income.
Stay tuned to All Things Policy. We'll be right back after a short commercial break.
So I think one of the loudest cheerleaders of high medical inflation are ironically the insurance companies, the health insurance companies, right?
Yeah.
So there have been reports which say, which peg India's health inflation at anywhere between 15 to 16%. And they, of course, counter-impose this statistic with the fact that insurance coverage in the country is lower. And I think that's a way to, you know, do their own marketing and persuade people. So that's just something I wanted to point out.
Yeah, you can, I mean, I've thought about this quite a bit. You can actually rip it apart and really, if you do a proper statistical study, you would find, I mean, yes, have prices gone up? I think you might conclude at the end of it that real prices might have gone up, but it's nowhere close to 15, 16%. I would imagine that to be more in the tune of, you know, 1 or 2%. And even then, not across the board. There will be definitely some things which have gotten a lot cheaper, some things which might have gotten more expensive due to the whole, you know, it's complicated. It's not that you can just, you can't paint some of these things with broad brushstrokes, right? Yeah. So that is just one bit that I want to say. I'll come to these two aspects about whether it's a good idea to have even that display of information. Now, let's even diagnose as to why we're saying we should display the standard rates on hospitals, you know, that entire thing in vernacular language and in English in a prominent place, etc. It's obviously that is coming from an idea of A, that it is there is some level of information asymmetry, that you don't necessarily know what is the standard rate of a particular procedure, and so you can't compare very easily. And two, of course, to facilitate comparison. So you go to one hospital, you look at the rates, you go to a second hospital, you look at the rates and decide. Now, this is obviously, we know that this is not exactly how it works. I mean, when you have, let's say, an emergency, you don't really go hospital shopping and look at the board and decide, you know, it's not like vegetable shopping, right? So I don't know how much that'll help, but okay. I mean, you know, I can probably understand at least where they're coming from. But there's so many more complications, and I just want to throw as to how, you know, we should appreciate the nuance, right? One, you can have a range perhaps, or even a precise point or a range, but understand that there's so much variation in room service. It's not just about the procedure, right? So, and you can have, depending on what kind of room you take, from a shared bed to a dorm to, you know, a private room with AC, with TV. And sometimes, you know, some of these hospitals have room service, which is better than most five-star hotels. I mean, you know, because, right? So, you know, you have all of that as well. Whether you have space for attendance, whether meals are included, whole bunch of things. But that's just the room. I mean, maybe you can even count for that. But I think there are more important things about complications, right? So not every single item of medical procedure is different from every other kind of procedure, right? Even a simple thing like root canal will be different based on, you know, how high up the root is in the bone, how complicated it is, whether there are other teeth which is coming in the way of these things, and so on. And then this is just, I'm talking about stupid, you know, teeth. But if you look at for something far more complex to do with internal organs, etc., the number of complications are going to be the same. I think the procedure that you follow for somebody with diabetes and somebody without diabetes, somebody with, you know, let's say BP and without BP, or whether what kind of other treatments are on, all of these things matter. So, you know, to ask surgeons to put up, or you know, hospitals to put up a price chart, as you would with you know, in the railway canteens, you have a price chart, right? As mandated, saying a Coca-Cola costs, you know, 20 rupees, Rail Neer costs 10 rupees, and so on. To expect hospitals to do something like this, I think is simplistic, again bordering on idiotic, right? Because it's going to be complicated. We are talking about extremely complex, heterogeneous products and services, and not a factory setting which has homogenized products. It's not a bottle of Coca-Cola which can have similar prices irrespective of what situation you find yourself in, right? And finally, I think you're also, by doing something like this, you'll have to come into question, you'll have to call into question whether doctors will want to go for more innovative treatment, not based on, you know, whether you have a price chart, right? So if you have a price chart, you'll want to do the bare minimum just so that you stick to that price chart. So I think there's a lot of complication I'll come to later about price fixing per se, but even putting up something like a price chart has problems with it. It's not that easy. So that's part A. But now, if you take this forward to saying, okay, we're going to fix the prices, right? Because that's what the Supreme Court has finally asked the government to do. Either the government fixes the price range, or that they will do it themselves using whatever CGS is. Price fixing is deeply problematic. I cannot emphasize how problematic something like price fixing is, right?
Yeah. So do you want to give us a brief on why price fixing in healthcare might, you know, sort of like kill the market, kill innovation and so on? Or should we just, you know, cut, copy, paste it from one of your previous episodes where we have talked about how price fixing is bad in the context of, you know, Ola cabs and Uber cabs in Bengaluru? So what would you prefer? Yeah. Do you want to rehash it?
I will rehash it until the cows come home. I mean, I don't even have to think about it, right? I have, it's almost like a mantra that is already there. I have to just take it up and read it. But let's just apply that in this context. Maybe give a fair warning to others. I've made all of these arguments 100 times before. You can listen to any of that. But in case you're new, go ahead, right? Okay, so few points. One, I think in a situation where we have such dire need of new hospitals coming up, where there is such a shortage of supply in most parts of the country. I mean, urban centers, I think, are doing fine, but imagine most rural areas do not have hospitals. And now you're going to say that we're going to fix prices for you. We're going to pay fixed prices for you such that we determine how much, irrespective of your cost, we determine how much money you can make or how much money you can lose. What incentive are you creating for new hospitals to come up? None. In fact, healthcare is going to get so much more expensive by price fixing, believe it or not, than otherwise. So forget about, again, as I said, it's far more cheaper, by the way, to provide healthcare in urban settings and rural settings. Urban settings, because you have what you call agglomeration effects. There are already doctors here. There are already, you know, medical equipment. It's easier to get. It's easier to buy medical devices, everything, right? Whereas all of these supply chains are much more difficult in rural areas. You have to pay a lot more to a doctor to to entice them to come and work in rural areas, right? So automatically, and you have to get most of medical equipment, surgical equipment, you have to get it from urban areas. Getting it serviced is a problem. All of that costs go up. So in rural areas, the cost of delivering healthcare will be more. And now you have a uniform fixed price across the board. You're not allowing anybody to charge more. What is the incentive for somebody to open up a hospital in rural areas? None. You've destroyed it. So then you'll only have the incumbents, maybe one or two, which had already been established earlier on, which have price fixed, you know, and they have now fixed prices. Do you think they're going to follow fixed prices? In fact, they get even more monopoly power. They get more market power because now they know that they have no competition that they have to, that will kind of discipline them, right? There's no competition in the market at all. And so they get even more pricing power and they will price, right? They will price high. So you can have fixed prices. One, do you have the state capacity to genuinely go after these fixed prices? There, you know, there are instances already, even during COVID, by the way, you had these fixed prices in urban areas. Do you think that was followed, Sri?
There were definitely ways to get around it. And
exactly,
people could get a bed if they had the right connection and the right influence, so to speak. So, of course, there was a huge, regulatory gap in that sense.
Precisely. So you will have massive amounts of, legal, illegal, quasi-legal, semi-legal activities to make up for that lost revenue, right? So, yeah, let's say even somehow you can use all of your state capacity to just make sure that, let's say, a procedure, cataract eye surgery, is fixed. Okay, and hospital charge no more than that. Like education, first thing, what you said is that you're going to have donations. And both of us made air quotes, even though we are obviously on a podcast. Yeah. But you're going to have donations. And that donation can come in any form. That is basically, you can charge higher for registration fees and say, we can't treat you unless you're registered. But registration fee just happens to be 10,000 rupees. Are you going to fix that?
Yeah.
Right. Then you can make it up through a whole bunch of other things. The price of the surgery might remain the same, but the price of the room will go up, and the price of the room can go up by 10x. Ambulance charges can go up, and then you can mandate that we'll only treat you if you use our ambulance. Right. And all of these things will make actually the process of healthcare worse. You can have visitor fee. Right now they don't do that, but you'll say, okay, every time somebody visits you, we're going to charge 2,000 rupees. Anything, any such thing. And you can impose saying that you can't get food from outside, only we will provide you food, and of course charge high for that, right? You can have maintenance and cleaning charges, saying that's not part of the procedure, but, if we'll do maintenance and cleaning charges. Again, that will be part of the procedure. Or the procedure itself can be very narrowly defined, and then you can follow the fixed price for that. But OPD is not, and you can throw most of it, you can cut the person up as a part of the procedure, but you can say stitching it up is OPD and say, sorry, and then charge high for that. So on and so forth, right? Trust people to be innovative. We've seen how people are innovative. And so, trust people to be innovative. If I can come up with these ideas, there are far more smarter people who can come up with a lot more.
Do you happen to own a clinical establishment? I don't think you came up with these overnight. You've been thinking about these innovative ways of making money. So you've been expecting this for a while. Let me just put that out.
This was an impromptu idea session of how you can charge more. Imagine if I had time, and imagine if the far more smarter people had more time, right? I'm sure they can come up with better solutions of how they can make money. But the idea is there will be workarounds. And we've seen this in every form of fixed prices. Every form of fixed prices where there are workarounds. And, that is not something that will solve the problem, right? Yeah. So that is the second point I want to make. Third, you have to understand that there is, when you remove that profit motive, you can have a situation where, for example, hospitals might shut down, or hospitals might just reduce the amount of things that they do only for things which are clearly profitable, even under the priced, under the fixed prices. And they might just leave out a whole bunch of things that, that are not profitable anymore. So what you've done, on one hand, you've made it difficult to open new ones, and therefore lessen competition. On the second hand, you will reduce supply. So the end result of it is that people will find it harder to access healthcare. And that is not what either the Supreme Court wants, nor the government, nor anybody else. So I think you have to really think through whether this is something that you want to do. And then you have a whole bunch of other problems. So you have a fixed price. Okay. So let's say you have, some particular surgery, you have a fixed price. And now the doctor is in a precarious condition, right? So let's say there's some complication that arises. Should the doctor actually advise for further, let's say, precautionary tests, just so that they understand the patient better? Or will they be, scared to do that because the prices are fixed? And because the next result of all of this will be saying that you have to hold somebody accountable. If you hold the doctors accountable for this, then they will be very wary of, let's say, suggesting any new methods, new procedures, or even just diagnostic tests to understand it better. Do we really want to make the people who we have entrusted our lives to extremely anxious about treating us? Is that a good situation? Just think about that. Do we want to make hospitals extremely careful and cautious about suggesting procedures to you? I don't think that's what we want, right? So all of this will distort incentives, will distort, you know, the way that procedures are done. Maybe everybody wants to take a safe approach. Let me end this particular bit with one of my favorite examples of unintended consequences, which is that, you know, in a particular situation, again, with the noblest of intentions, you had this idea where the government forced all hospitals to come up with, to establish and print out, you know, mortality rates. Basically, how many patients were admitted in the hospital and how many of them died during hospitalization. Right? This was forced, and this was done with the intention that, okay, patients will see this, we can get a better idea of how good or bad our hospital is, and then, you know, can choose. Seemingly good idea, Sri. Do you agree?
No.
No. Okay. So why not? Right? We know the result. What happens to the incentive? Now, what happened was hospitals wanted, obviously, every hospital wanted the least amount of mortality rate, you know, as close to zero as possible. And so what the hospital started doing was just stop admitting any patient which had the risk of death. So patients who were truly critical, who really needed hospitalization, were the ones who were refused admission into the hospital. That is exact opposite.
What was
effect and outcome of what they wanted, right? So people who had maybe a minor scratch would be admitted, but people who had, like, you know, maybe a heart attack, who had, you know, 50-50 chance of making it, you're now refusing admission. That's not what you want, right? So policy decisions have deep consequences. They have unintended consequences, which I think in this case, the Supreme Court and the earlier 2012 Clinical Establishment Act or whatever that is completely ignoring and overseeing at the moment. And this is being done at great peril.
Yeah. No, thanks for that fantastic explanation, Anupam. I think you've really brought out the distortionary effects that fixing price cap in healthcare can lead to. And in fact, just about the act, I think the funny part is that was not even the legislative intent. I don't think the parliament intended to fix rates. It just happened that the executive brought out some rules which said that, there is a provision now that the central government will decide the range of rates that hospitals can charge and so on, which the court is now trying to enforce without even checking what the actual intent of the law was. That I think is a judicial tragedy. But what you pointed out was even more scary, because this is real consequences to the real lives of people, because you might have a situation where the overall quality of healthcare suffers, you know, overall expansion of healthcare industry in the country suffers, and the price distortions can have the minutest effects, from, you know, a doctor prescribing a particular treatment to a medical student opting a particular course. So thanks for pointing all of this out. We will sort of wait and see what will be the outcome. Will the government and the state governments push back? Of course, now I'm sure the clinical establishments themselves might push back and might seek intervention before the court. So all that is yet to come in the next few weeks. But Anupam, the problem still remains. India is a large country with a huge population, and it's also a slightly aging population. Public healthcare in India is poor. You know, public healthcare services are also not enough. Private healthcare, we have some interventions in the form of insurance policy, say your Ayushman Bharat card and so on. But if you generally look at the healthcare sector in India, if you had to, you know, quickly give us pointers on what should be, first, what are the market failures? And second, what should be the government intervention in healthcare? And definitely not fixing price gap for all the reasons that you mentioned. What would those look like?
Yeah, you're right. Just because I'm dismissing this particular solution does not mean that the problem does not exist. Healthcare continues to be, it's a very tricky subject. I don't think any economist can say with a great amount of confidence saying this is the answer to healthcare. I don't think any country can stand up and say, you know, we've solved healthcare, because there are a whole bunch of problems. I mean, we know that the healthcare in the US is a nightmare. In fact, I've said this previously and I'll say this again. Any day of the week, any day of the year, I will choose the Indian healthcare system over the US healthcare system, because I think that has deep distortions of another level. I mean, that's deep distortion from a political economy angle, where you have insurance lobbying completely screwing up the entire kind of healthcare system, whereas it's impossible for somebody to access healthcare without insurance, and then it's very expensive, right? So I don't wish that upon the worst of my enemies, in fact, the US healthcare system. The UK healthcare system is another nightmare. It's on the opposite end of the spectrum, but that's the national health scheme, you know, the NHS, which exists, and that has its own set of problems where, you know, you can't get, again, it's accessibility problems. It's free for everybody, but you can't get an appointment. So even if you have a critical, you know, let's say hip replacement, the surgery without which you can't move, you have to wait 6 months or 8 months or sometimes 10 months in order to get an appointment. Right? So even that is problematic. In fact, in some ways, I think India has got the right mix. It might seem unbelievable for many people who are listening to this, but I think India has got a better mix. We have both public and private healthcare. It is affordable. It's accessible to a large extent and so on. But there are problems that exist. It's still, because we have such a large population, percentage of the population below, I wouldn't say below poverty line. I think that's been improving. That's an entirely different podcast for another day. But I think people who cannot afford the range of treatment available, right? I think that continues to be a problem. So what can be done? I'm going to be very quick about this because we don't have time. There's already been a long podcast. But I think one of the things to think about is this kind of universal healthcare plan. So your Ayushman Bharat, etc., can we truly expand that, make it work? And so you have like a large insurance provider who are negotiating health costs and so on behalf of the patient. That itself can have unintended consequences. Like in the US, Medicare and Medicaid, there are issues where hospitals can refuse admission to Medicare patients, etc. All of that can happen. But I'm sure that it's, is it better than status quo? I would say yes. And there are ways to navigate through that. So I think one is just have more people have health insurance across the board and then have a universal healthcare plan as well provided by the government or different parties, but you know, guaranteed by the government in some way. That's just one of the ideas. I think this particular thing about information asymmetry, I think can be fought through, you know, better, greater availability of second opinions, even government-provided ones, right? So you can have a system where you can have second, you know, make it really, truly accessible for second opinions in this thing, right? So that itself is truly bringing in the competition angle. One of the big problems, if you know, is that while competition exists on paper, that is, there are many hospitals, the idea is once you go into a hospital, you're not really going to go, as I said, hospital shopping. You don't go to 10 other hospitals and say, okay, what is the price of this surgery? It becomes difficult, right? Whereas now, this is something that tech can solve. Tech can truly solve this. You can, you know, I mean, imagine an app where you put up your complaints by and large and get quotes from different hospitals, right? And then you go to the one which has better rating plus better kind of pricing mechanism. I mean, this is just, again, it took me 3 seconds to come up with this. I'm sure smarter people can come up with better solutions, right? And then, of course, you have user-generated ratings and reviews. If this can work from for plumbing and electricians and things like Urban Company and for Uber drivers and for Amazon products and so on, there's no reason why you can have large amount of user-generated reviews. It already exists. Practo, for example, exists. Yeah. Practo and, you know, 1MG and a whole bunch of these things exist where you get good kind of rating, the rating and review system for doctors. You can expand that for hospitals, right? And truly one that is accessible to a large number of people. And that can solve your information asymmetry problem. If, for example, enough number of people are duped or go through expensive surgeries where none were required, etc., I think, you know, it just requires enough number of people to put that up and say, you know, this is what is happening here, and people will shy away, and that automatically will keep many of the hospitals in check. Right, so that's second. The third, and I think in all of this, we've so conveniently neglected the role of the public sector in all of this. Government runs a lot of hospitals. Can we then demand that government actually does its part well? Can we ask for them to clean up its own house first? Can we ask them to upgrade the standards of public hospitals? Can we ensure that there's no doctor absenteeism, which means that can they pay the doctors better? Right? There's a whole bunch of things that government hospitals can do to ensure better quality of service at more affordable rates. This, why are we letting them off the hook so easily? Right. So I think that's the final thing. Finally, and I think what we should be doing is looking into the reasons for high costs associated with medical care. And some of that can be fixed rather easily. Some of it is very difficult, but some of it can be fixed. Can we look at, for example, and reduce the import duty on medical equipment? Why are we putting import duty on medical equipment? That's what makes it tougher. Reduce it, zero. Make it zero import duty, right? Make it cheaper and easier to obtain licenses. reduce unnecessary regulatory burden and compliance costs, ensure that there's adequate competition in the industry by, you know, making it easy for hospitals to come up. I think these are some of the things that we can immediately do from a government angle, which is entirely in the purview of the government, to make it easier for hospitals to reduce costs. I think this is just a starting point, right? These are things that can be done to make healthcare both accessible, equitable, reduce price, etc. But fixing prices is not the way to go about it.
Right. Thank you, Anupam, for this fantastic chat today. And if I may add just one more thing, I think improving our consumer liability regime also will have very positive consequences for quality of healthcare in the country, because we see innumerable stories of people who had to fight 10 years, 15 years to get justice because, you know, they were prescribed the wrong drug or the operation and the surgery was not conducted properly by the doctors. Sometimes even in reputed hospitals who have enough, you know, money to fight the case till the end. And this itself, you know, fixing the system where you have faster disposal of medical negligence cases can have a impact on hospitals as far as their quality of services is concerned. Anyway, thanks once again for joining me today, and let's watch out what happens in the Supreme Court over the next few weeks or months, and happy to have you back to offer discussion on the second part to this episode today. Thanks.
Thank you, Sri.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is at IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaInst. Or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.